Hey, welcome to the Push Pull Sales and Marketing Podcast. I'm Marcello.
And I'm Sherry. And each episode will provide you with sales and marketing strategies that you can implement immediately into your own business.
I'd like to introduce to the show, I have Deb Calvert. She is one of the authors of the new best-selling book, Stop Selling and Start Leading, How to Make Extraordinary Sales Happen. Deb, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marcello. I am just delighted to be here. I love what you and Sherry have been doing with Push-Pull Sales. It's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. So for somebody who never heard of you before, or kind of like, if you can kind of provide us just some background, tell us a little bit about yourself, what your interests are, all that good stuff. So just so people can kind of get acquainted with you.
Well, the important stuff is that I have recently moved to a rural property and I have the most amazing springtime happening. I'd lived in California in a big city for a while, so this is good fun. But what took me out there to California was working for a Fortune 500, and then they closed their doors. So I went into business for myself 12 years ago.
Closed their doors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. A media company called Knight Ridder. Folks will maybe remember it. It was at the time second largest media company in the country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was overseeing sales and training and leadership development. By the time I lost that opportunity and didn't want to move again, so I stayed in California, opened up my own company, People First Productivity Solutions. And one of the things that I've been doing over the past 12 years and even earlier was researching in field buyers and sellers both. And so I wrote a book 5 years ago, just released this new one, and it's based on buyer research and seller stories.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And I'm always fascinated, and that's why I like this book so much too, because like it's definitely on the business to business side too. And it's so interesting, like when you dive into that actual data and you talk to, you know, different purchasing managers, you know, you talk to different sellers, and it's very interesting when you have those separate conversations and you really find out like what the actual disconnect was. Like I believe we had a previous gentleman, Kurt Mortensen, and he actually had the data in terms of like what is like the top thing, like in terms of complaints of actual like purchasing managers and all that good stuff. And I think it was interesting. I think number one obviously is sellers don't actually listen. And I believe number two was coffee breath, which was very interesting to hear. It was very interesting to kind of hear how high up it was. All right. So right now, so for your company, People First Productivity. So what exactly are you doing right now? You know, and kind of, you kind of walk us through some of that journey. I mean, obviously you've been doing this for a while, but what are you doing today? What is the focus of your business?
Yeah, ever since day one, focus has always been building organizational strength by putting people first. And what I mean by that is, you know, you want the profits, the processes, the programs, whatever else you've got going. But if you want any of that, you have to develop and equip people to make it happen. It seems so simple, but I think companies often lose sight of that. So we provide leadership development, sales productivity services, and team effectiveness training and facilitation to help put people first, right back where they belong in the organization, so that you can reach your goals.
Gotcha. Now, in terms of maybe an ideal client type, or where do you say, or who do you think benefits the most from your type of services? I mean, are these companies that might have, you know, a three-tiered organization where you have your frontline associates, some kind of middle managers, and maybe like VPs of sales, or do you feel like it has to be smaller, bigger? Where do you say is kind of like an ideal fit for your type of services?
Yeah, we've worked with big and small, family-owned, very small businesses all the way up to international corporations. My preference and the place where I feel like we have the most impact the fastest are typically mid-size organizations up to about 2,500 employees. And it is companies, what really makes the difference is that they truly, at the leadership level, senior executives really do want to put people first. I've done the other. I've been brought in by large organizations where, hey, we're on the, you know, list of the top 10 worst places in the world to work. Can you fix us? No, oh, I can't fix you. I've tried.
That's funny.
But you got to be willing, right? You have to make changes.
Sure, sure. And it's kind of interesting, too, because a lot of times in those type of organizations and kind of interviewing different people on the podcast, you always ask, like, all right, so how do you kind of make things stick, or how do you change that? How do you change that culture there? How do you, like, make, like, the day after training? Like, how do you make that actually resonate with people. And he's like, I can tell pretty, or most people say, I can tell pretty quickly right after, we leave, if the middle management, if the upper management isn't present there, if they just push this, hey, this is something that I want to push to my people, I'll come back at the end. Then obviously, it's obviously not going to stick. And the other thing that's interesting, when you talk about leadership, and culture and all that, it can't just be from a top down. It's also got to be bottom up too. And it's very interesting how you can kind of find that dynamic. So my question for you kind of leading into that is what are some common, scenarios, or what are some common questions that you'd hear from somebody who might approach you, for your services? I mean, what are some things you normally hear? What kind of concerns do people have?
Yeah, you mentioned one already, which is, look, we've had consultants and we've had coaches and we've had training and it just doesn't stick. What can you do differently to make it stick? Or maybe they've heard about a success I've had somewhere else and they ask, how come? What did you do differently? And one of the things that we do right at the front end is we make sure that the leadership executive team and that the frontline managers who are going to be involved, that they're all going to get something before it just trickles down to the frontline staff. And then the something that they get, that's based on something from the staff, because we do a lot of surveying. We customize everything that we do. But I want everyone to know that training is coming. I want them to have a voice in shaping it. And I want them to take a survey, because that tells us where we can pinpoint the areas that people have expressed an interest or a need. Then we take that to the management and the leadership team, and we have them get an opportunity to react to it. And there's some sort of executive level overview, input, plan for past training, what's the reinforcement going to look like over the long term, and only then are we really ready to launch some sort of intervention, training, coaching, whatever it is that we do.
Gotcha. So let me ask you this. So in terms of resistance to, because whenever there's any kind of change organizationally, I mean, you have some kind of resistance. Where have you seen, especially for some of these mid-sized organizations, where have you seen that actual resistance comes from? Do you feel like it is some of those middle managers that are like, look, I'm working in this every day, and I have my ear to the ground. I kind of know what's going on. I don't think it really makes sense to bring in somebody to kind of do this stuff. Like, where are you hearing some of that resistance in some of these mid-level organizations? I'm always curious to see how they manage that, because it's interesting when you have that level of people and what's going on. Where are you seeing that resistance?
Well, it's typically two places. It's either the person who feels threatened by change, whatever that change might be, mm-hmm. or it's the person who doesn't understand it. And maybe they even have their own identity and their own success somehow wrapped in the way things have been. Classic example. Sometimes maybe I'm going in to do sales training, and sometimes there's a sales trainer who wasn't given an opportunity to be a part of someone saying, hey, we need sales training. So poof, now they're talking to me and maybe a couple other vendors. They're supposed to pick something that feels to them like others in the organization are saying, you didn't do your job. When, it might just be the opposite message. We're trying to help you to expand the impact that you have. But until it's positioned that way, we're human, wouldn't you feel threatened too?
Sure,
if you didn't understand why and what people were looking for. So yeah, it's gotta be for people who you're asking to make a change. They have to understand that it's an extension of, not a replacement for, the contributions that they've made.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So kind of leading into that then. So especially you have some kind of skepticism sometimes with that, or just some kind of resistance to change. What would you say sets apart your organization and what you do than versus some other people who are trying to kind of get, especially in that space? I mean, a lot of people think management consulting, it sounds good. You have a lot of money in there, especially a lot of these guys who are graduating, from the Ivy League schools, they want to jump right into that. What would you say sets apart your organization from some of your competitors out there?
Well, we really do try to live up to our belief that it's all about people first. Mm-hmm. So the person who's going to be impacted by the training, who will attend the training, who will have the follow-up responsibilities for the training, I need to know from all of them what their needs are. And then we customize the program to meet those needs. Another difference is that we do customize. We don't have off-the-shelf programs. Certainly, we have starter programs, but in any organization, there are things that have come before us. And so our customization is to dignify what's happened before, to build on it, to show parallels to it, to let people know that we're not latest, greatest. We don't have that kind of an ego walking in the door. Mm-hmm. But we certainly do want to help them leverage what they've already had before and to build right on top of it to keep it going to that next level where they want it to be.
Yeah. So another question I would have here, just kind of thinking about and kind of looking you up and what you do in terms of setting up expectations for some kind of, you know, leadership change or some kind of cultural change within an organization and really how the organization works. What do you feel like is really a good time frame for that? Like, what do you think in terms of like, when can you expect like the first like real shift in thinking, maybe shift in action? And then when do you think it kind of like snowballs from there for well, let's just go ahead and say an organization for anywhere from like 1 to 5,000 employees?
Yeah, I'm glad you clarified, because it does depend on how close in proximity those folks are to each other and how many of them that there are. Mm-hmm. It depends on the people internally and how committed and driven they are. So I'll give you an example. I'm working currently with an organization that has 71 markets. And across this organization, we are doing a same program for sales managers in each of the markets that we go to. Mm-hmm. And it's a 26-week program. I'm not involved for 26 weeks, but there are a series of webinars and some on-site training. But every one of those weeks, the sales managers are doing something. And it's all about getting a culture change that will be similar across the entire organization. We've had two markets, one market finish and one market getting very close to finishing, a third market that has ramped up about halfway. And all three of them are already reporting some pretty significant change. That's because the managers and the leadership team are extremely committed. And we've broken it down into manageable chunks so that we can look at those changes week to week and over the time of the program to see what they are. Now, wholesale culture change, you need more time. If it's going to be sweeping across an entire organization, every division, 5,000 people, that's not going to happen probably in 26 weeks. You can see inroads. Mm-hmm. But to get that kind of wholesale culture change, it has to be well communicated. Skeptical people need time to be able to stand back and see it happening consistently and to know what that vision is and where we're going so that they can see evidence that this is something that's all cohesive. It fits together.
Right. And that obviously makes sense too. And that's why you can't go from, you know, the top 10 worst places, or you go and you see on Glassdoor and you see on Indeed, all the actual reviews and all that good stuff. You know, it's something that obviously takes a while for some of these larger organizations. My question for you again, kind of thinking about some of those dynamics, and I used to work for a couple Fortune 500 companies, and some of the interesting dynamics I would see there, especially are between maybe your inside sales department and some of your outside sales reps, or maybe some of the people who are, as the model shifts and you get a little bit more towards segmenting, it's all right, this person is going to be a qualifier. They'll do some kind of lead generation, and then they'll hand that off to some kind of account executive who'll kind of go through more. Where do you see some of the challenges when you differentiate some of those actual sales roles between a fully inside sales team versus some of your outside sales reps? How do you manage that in a sales organization?
Yeah, you know, so you're talking about now process, not so much culture, and process is managed differently than culture. So to make a process like that work, if you are introducing a change and saying, okay, now we're going to have, let's say, you're going to have SDRs now in the organization, and they're going to hand off to account executives. Mm-hmm. That's all about people understanding very specifically what the roles and responsibilities and rules are so that it's not a blur and a jumble. And as with any change, you have to have an ending before you're going to have a new beginning. So if it's blurry, if it's confusing, if people who are now account executives can still do the work that SDRs are doing, that's where it all becomes just a mess, because you haven't had a definitive end to how we used to do things, beginning with clear roles and responsibilities and rules about how we are doing things now.
Sure. And then you talk about process too, and that's definitely part of it. And also culturally too, where I, especially at, it was it was primarily a sales organization. There was a little bit of a disconnect in between what the outside sales organization could quote unquote get away with and then versus what the actual inside sales reps were actually doing, even though if you look as things kind of developed and changed, the inside sales team was able to almost produce as much as the actual outside sales teams were. As before, you'd kind of segment, all right, well, the inside sales team, and they can do anywhere from like one to like an actual 50 employee company. So it was a relatively smaller organizations that they were actually marketing to. And then as they kind of rolled out and tested things and said, you know what, there's no reason why somebody who's in an inside sales role can't handle maybe a 200, a 500, a 1,000 person organization, yeah, in terms of marketing the product there. How do you shift that, and how do you change that culture there when you have a little bit of like combativeness, or maybe even between territories where, hey, you know, the West Coast team is doing something phenomenal here. You know, there's something going on there, but they're not sharing best practices, and you know, you have different stack rankings. Like, how do you deal when you have that little bit of a culture? Hey, everybody's kind of looking out for themselves. Because a lot of times, I think, and that's kind of why I got away from some of the, you know, Fortune 500 companies, because I didn't like that culture. You know, I feel like a rising tide raises all ships, and sometimes you see when you segment things where you don't have that. How do you combat that?
Yeah, I think that there's a whole lot wrapped up in what you said there, Marcello. So let me break part of it down. So I feel really sorry for sales managers, first of all, because they are asked to go out and drive revenue, and that is not easy. And they will drive revenue, and they will find ways to get the revenue number met no matter what. Mm-hmm. And if there are blurred lines, that means that they are sometimes going to step on each other's toes. And then it becomes a situation of internal competition, a lot of energy expended on internal competition that's very unhealthy for organizations.
It's toxic.
Yep. What we need then is not just sales management. Now we need people leadership, whether it's the sales managers or now it's the sales VPs or whoever's involved. Leadership of the sales team to be able to say, look, we're all in this together. And to be able to say, it's not just me, it's not just my number, my team. If we are going to be a healthy, thriving organization, if we're going to think long-term instead of short-term, we better get our act together, because otherwise the competition is going to eat our lunch as we waste all this time and energy.
Absolutely.
That is it's not easy. That's a conflict of interest for a lot of sales managers to be able to do that, because it means taking potentially money out of their pocket if they're paid on a plan that's similar to whatever their sales reps are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it take was your question. It takes leadership being able to watch for those signs, protect the culture, whatever the culture is meant to be, and to be able to get ahead of, to proactively troubleshoot so that it is a healthy, thriving sales organization, not just a bunch of sales teams pitted against each other.
And this is something that when you bring in somebody like your organization, it's a little bit easier to actually see that when you're doing the surveys and when you're doing some of your, I would kind of say like account prep work, so that we can kind of customize things. I think it's easier when you have somebody kind of taking like an actual, you know, 360 view of the organization, and someone who doesn't necessarily have, you know, a whole competitive, you know, skin in the game. Whereas, yeah, you do have competitive managers, and again, you're kind of stepping on each other's toes. One question I would have for you, then, I don't think I have a bunch of questions about the book. In terms of your organization as a whole, can you give me an example of maybe what you're the most proud of, right? Or maybe a recent example, again, how your services helped an organization, what you saw, what that process looked like?
Yes. To me, it's all about making a difference. So when one of my trainers or coaches is out there and working with a group, whether it's training or coaching individuals, coaching executives, whether it's been a consulting engagement where they're fixing some of the process and productivity issues, when somebody can say, come back to us and say, doing what you advised us, it was hard, we weren't sure, but it really made a difference. Here's where we were, here's where we are. That's what it's all about to me. And some recent examples of differences like that we've been able to make. In one organization, we have now taken about 80 people through an emerging leaders program over the past 4 years. And they have completely shifted their culture, their business practices, their target customers that they go after. They are in an entirely different ballgame, frankly, about the nature of the work that they do. And that's all just because they improved retention and employee engagement and customer retention as people began to see themselves as leaders and having leadership at every level, not just at the very top of the org chart. So that's one recent example. There's another one that's similar, just a very small company, only four people in the UK. And they were at a crossroads. Are we going to shut our doors or are we going to do what we wanted to do when we set out 4 years ago? We need help to figure that out. And so I've consulted with them now for about 20 weeks, and they have made some pretty significant changes. They're back on track. They got several new clients, and it's not a question anymore. We are going to do what we set out to do. There's no more of this, we might have to close our doors talk, because things have been fixed.
Gotcha. Very cool. So kind of talking about the book here, and again, it's obviously good to hear that. And again, the variety of businesses that you're actually able to help. I mean, how did the idea like kind of come about? I mean, again, in terms of some of the leadership principles and everything from some of the data from some of your co-authors, did you approach them? Did they approach you? How did like this whole idea get shaped, and how long was that process?
It was a very fast process of the idea, and then a slower process because of the amount of research that's involved. My co-authors are Jim Kouzis and Barry Posner, and they are two of the foremost authorities on leadership. Pretty much anything you'll read about modern leadership has them in the footnotes, because they've been working for over 30 years to identify and observe and validate the actual behaviors of leaders that cause people to choose that they would willingly follow them. So it's well steeped, lots of evidence in the work that they've done.
Awesome.
Well, I've been attracted to that work for many years. I've worked with it. I've trained it. I became a facilitator of it. And then I decided about 5 years ago to become a certified master. There aren't that many of them, but Jim and Barry, they have a rigorous process. It's not easy to get that level of mastery with their program. So I was being mentored by Barry Posner. That in and of itself was an amazing opportunity. It's more than a year-long process to earn that credential. And while I was in that process and really being challenged to think about leadership and what I was observing in people's behaviors every day, it just sort of hit me one day as I was working in the sales part of my business. It hit me that, you know, buyers are resistant to sellers, but what if sellers exhibited these behaviors of leaders? Would their buyers more willingly follow them? What would happen? And I took that question to Barry and Jim. They liked it. And we embarked on a research project that became a book.
That's awesome. So when do you feel like, and again, almost every single person who we've had on the show and even myself has kind of observed, the selling environment has absolutely changed, and especially within that business to business environment too. And you talk about in the book, again, you have buyers who are a lot more skeptical. There's definitely more pressure in terms of, you know, getting some kind of price concession. You know, you definitely have an environment too where buyers are obviously more empowered too, where they can get a lot of the information and they can kind of do everything up front. When do you feel like things have actually shifted where some of these old selling models just don't work anymore?
It's been gradual, but you know, it shouldn't be a surprise to any of us. It's been over 20 years since a couple of authors put out a book that predicted that this would happen. And one of the things I love about their prediction, they said that consumers, all of us in buying roles, B2B or B2C, we're going to gravitate toward the businesses that give us an opportunity to be participants in creating what we want. Okay, so let me park on that for a minute. So in our own B2C experiences as consumers, this is what we do. We go to Build-A-Bear workshop, DIY workshops at Home Depot. We go to Chipotle and other quick serve places where we get to say, I want a little more of that, a little less of that, and make mine special in these ways. It's all custom. Mm-hmm. But then over here in B2B, even though that's what our buyers are experiencing in their everyday lives as consumers, in B2B, we don't allow people to participate in creating what they want. We don't understand the experience that they're looking for and how much value is in that when they are putting their own imprint on the ideas and the solutions that we come up with. So we miss this huge opportunity. And that's been going on, I think, in increasing gradients for at least a decade and probably more, because it's become the experience economy. And we all know customer experience has become a big deal at so many companies, but we haven't translated to what that means right here to each individual salesperson and what they're missing. If we want to get away from those pressures that buyers put on us to make price concessions, then we've got to stop making the conversation be about price. We have to create an experience that brings value to them. People get excited and they'll pay a lot more when there's an experience for them that's very enabling and ennobling. So that's the part of being a leader, of being able to really guide your buyers into a place where they're going to have a good time and it's going to make you different from all the other sellers out there.
Absolutely. And I like how you kind of framed that up in the book, and you talk about, you know, changing the heart and changing, again, just even changing the actual thought process to, I'm a salesperson versus I'm an actual leader. Sometimes just even small shifts like that in terms of how you actually see yourself and how you kind of vision, you know, what you're actually doing makes a huge difference. So for example, I used to work for a home improvement company, and our sales went up when we changed from, I believe that our card said, you know, sales rep to actual, it switched it over to actual design consultant. And that wasn't so much because if somebody sees the card says sales rep, oh, sales rep, whatever. But it also changed that actual shift too. So, well, no, I'm helping these people actually design how they want their home to be, you know, whether that's a new bath system, whether that's a new sunroom or new windows or pretty much whatever the product was. You know, it's definitely interesting. I like how you kind of talk about, and Anthony Annarino talks about this as well in a lot of his stuff. A lot of it, it's not just an actual skill set thing. It's actually shifting that actual mindset and why you have those actual leadership principles and why that makes a difference. But again, love the book. Again, if you're in business to business sales, I mean, I think it's pretty much a must read. A follow up question here, again, in terms of changing some of that, do you feel like that by going through this process here and going through, you know, that actual shift, do you feel like that obviously helps shorten the sales cycle? Does it really have any kind of impact in terms of the actual sales cycle too for a lot of organizations? Because I think you have managers, and again, when you think about pressure, I'll say, well, hey, this is great, but you know, if I don't get to this price part, whatever, if I have that conversation, it might actually elongate the process because maybe I'm not creating that sense of urgency. Like, do you feel like, is there any change in terms of that actual sales cycle, whether it keeps it the same? Does it make it longer? Does it make it a little bit shorter? Like, what have you actually seen?
Yes. Well, let me start with what buyers told us. They first told us that, yes, they would be more likely to take a meeting with a seller who exhibited these leadership behaviors, mm-hmm. and they'd be more likely to buy from one. So then we went and we looked at sellers. We just looked at the personal best stories from sellers to see if that showed up, if these leadership behaviors showed up when they were at their own personal best making extraordinary sales. And in over 500 stories that we collected, in fact, the behaviors did show up. So what it looks like is you get to choose between spending your time making 15 callbacks and then getting a continuance. Oh, yeah, that sounds good. Call me back next month. And then you get handed off to somebody else. And you spend an enormous amount of time. The sales cycle is lengthened by, frankly, a lack of motivation, a lack of genuine interest on the part of the buyer, even if they do need what you're selling. when you turn it into a relationship where the seller is leading, they're guiding the buyer by inspiring them with a shared vision, by getting them excited because they're enabled, they're participating in creating what they want, when you're encouraging them as leaders do, all of that accelerates the sales cycle. It accelerates every decision. It gives the buyer some of the enthusiasm and the passion that's otherwise lacking so that they will stay on it and they'll do the internal work and they'll take the phone calls that you make and they'll look forward to having those meetings with you because you're creating value and it's an experience they look forward to.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of that too, when you talk about, you know, customizing and focusing more on the actual, buyer, another challenge a lot of sales reps have, especially when you kind of make this, especially when you're making this shift, is how can I become that leader? How can I actually bring some kind of unique insight that I'm going to get somebody's attention more, where something's not going to get lost in that shuffle? So again, we're talking about, and probably the hardest thing, because I think as soon as you engage somebody in this model, any kind of change, you know, how you actually approach your customers, you know, how you're moving them along the actual process, I definitely think it certainly helps too, because it's not so much, hey, here's a product and I believe it's going to meet your needs, you know, or you can go with this other one. It might not meet your needs as much. It's a little bit more matter of fact toward the end and say, hey, based off of your goals, you know, you're going to have to do this, and this is how much, and this is how much it's actually going to cost to go ahead and actually establish that, and thinking about doing that, then it's not so much an actual price concession. Well, based off the goal that you want and based off of my past experience, if you were to do something differently, you know, again, that's more of a leadership thing. You're kind of adapting some of that challenger sales model. How can sales reps right now get everything started? Like, how can they better engage an actual prospect? Because again, in terms of some of these touch points, a lot of this book, a lot of it will focus on how they're moving along the process, but how do you get somebody's attention quicker? How do you kind of like bring in some kind of unique insight that's going to make that customer start the process?
You know, everybody wants these magic bullet answers, and there is only one magic bullet answer. It's not a model like even Challenger Sale. It's not something as simple as skill set, tool set, mindset. All of those things are contextual. They give you some ideas. They help you to determine some of the things that you need to look at. But it boils down to one thing. It boils down to, are you giving your buyer space, or are you trying to use all your tricks and tools and techniques and shortcuts and magic bullets to do it for them, to say exactly the right thing, to do exactly the right thing, to call at the right time, to make your email the certain 5 bullet points that are going to change the world? Right? It's none of that. That's all context. Are you putting your buyer in a situation that they want to be in, where it's engaging and it's interesting and it's fun, and because you are just opening up that space, they get to be a participant in creating what they want? And what's best news of all is that this is so much easier than anything else that you could do, right? Because the buyer fills in the blanks. You don't have to. All you have to do is make space for that to happen.
And you're going to have a lot more fun in the process too, because you're going to be engaged with you're going to have a more engaged buyer, and likewise, you know, you'll probably be spending less time in terms of less ideal situations. But I appreciate you saying that. Like, there really is no magic bullet, and you can take all the things, and again, that's why we do this podcast here, to give some kind of nugget, some kind of insight, you know, whether it's exactly what you said, you know, putting 5 bullet points, or having 70 characters in an email, you know, or in a subject line, having all that information is definitely helpful. But when you take this 360 approach, I definitely think it makes a difference. So in terms of, again, kind of bringing everything in place, you know, kind of adapting and all that good stuff, what would you say would be a good recommendation for our listeners right now? Again, obviously there is no silver bullet or anything like that, but what would you say would be a good recommendation for our listeners right now? Could be a book, could be an app, or some kind of course. Obviously, excluding your own stuff, because we're gonna have links to that in the actual show notes. But what would be a good resource for our listeners?
It's all, they have it all already. Whatever they've read, whatever they've seen, whatever they've done, they have it. They just don't realize they have it. It's inside of themselves. Every seller has the potential to be a leader. And using whatever it is that they've known and what's ever resonated with them, whatever springboard they've already taken in, they just have to use it. They have to think of themselves as leaders who are there to guide their buyers, and then they have to be confident and ennoble themselves, right? Worthy, important. They have to know, they have to feel dignified that they can help their buyers. They can guide their buyers to a better place where the buyer wants to be. Stop waiting around for those magic bullets. Don't make it too hard. Just be that leader and do it.
Awesome. I like that. And you're the first person to not offer an actual specific book or resource. I like that. It's very unique.
Well, I could do that too. I'm a big reader and there are a lot of books I love out there, but right, enough. Do this instead. Do this first.
I like that. And the other thing too is then you're not waiting for some additional information, like before you get started, you're not waiting for an actual title, like before you actually consider yourself an actual, you know, leader. I definitely like that. So in terms of, let's just say people, you know, this sounds very interesting, you know, kind of changing some of that model and kind of thinking it more of a leadership, taking some of these principles, taking some of this research, you know, in place. Cause I believe in the book, was it over 500 different industries or was it 500 different buyers? How many different data sets that you actually have to kind of compile this?
Mm-hmm. So this was a Qualtrics panel study conducted through Santa Clara University. We had 530 verified B2B buyers representing a cross-section of all industries, age groups, levels of buying, complexity of buying, et cetera. So it was a very comprehensive look at the selection to get that every buyer represented.
That's incredible to have that. So let's just say, hey Deb, I like what you have to say. I want to pick up a copy of the book. I want to find out a little bit more about maybe how you can help my organization. How can our listeners best get a hold of you? Is that LinkedIn? Is that on your website? How do they actually get a hold of you?
Yeah. So start at the book website. You can read the book. Stop Selling, Start Leading is the website. Mm-hmm. The book has the word and in it, Stop Selling and Start Leading. Mm-hmm. I'm Deb Calvert, and my company website is out there, People First PS. That's for productivity solutions, peoplefirstps.com. But Deb Calvert on LinkedIn, at People First PS on other social media. You'll find my phone number out there. You know, email me, call me. Stop me the next time we're at the same conference together, whatever we need to do. I would like to meet your listeners and talk to them more.
That's awesome. Do you have any kind of final thoughts or any kind of final words of wisdom for our listeners?
Yeah. I mean, if you didn't hear anything else, take this seriously, whether you know it or not, and whether you like it or not, you already are a leader. And if you're not intentional about your leadership, you're still guiding people. Problem is you're taking them to a place you don't intend to. So think about yourself as a leader, step into your potential, and just start leading. You can do it.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. We definitely appreciate having you on the show. For our listeners, we're going to have links to all the show notes, to the website. And I believe we'll also have an actual giveaway. So what we'll do is we'll set up some kind of sign-up link so you can sign up. You can actually get away. I believe is it the first chapter of the book?
Yeah, let's do the whole first chapter, no cost. Let people get a sneak preview of it.
Awesome. So, yeah, so we'll actually have a link to that. So we'll go ahead and set that up for you. But, Deb, thank you so much. Again, phenomenal book. I love when you can put together all this research and all this data, and it's not so much here's one premise in terms of my book, and I'm going to kind of rehash the same thing 30 times, and there's not really any substance behind it. This book has me to it. This book has actual data driven behind it. And I love seeing that. But yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcello. I really appreciate your time and your audience.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
That wraps things up for this episode. And wanted to remind you guys that you can always find show notes at pushpullsales.com. You can also connect with us on social media. We are at pushpullsales on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can reach out to us anytime if you have feedback or topic suggestions or want to be a guest on the show. You can simply email us pushpullsales@gmail.com. You can also support our show at patreon.com/pushpullsales. Thank you to bensound.com for our intro and outro music. And thanks to you guys for listening. Tune in next time where we'll tackle another topic. See ya.